charge of the terrorism prevention branch of the UN, which was part of the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. But most of the work I did in that area was legal, and basically going to legislative drafters in developing countries and trying to upgrade the legislation so that it was in conformity with Security Council resolutions like 1373 that asked member states to harmonize their legislation. This morning I was listening with great interest to what some of the speakers said, and they said also a lot of things I planned to say, but they could say it with much more detail. So I will try to improvise a little bit. I missed, unfortunately, last night's the dinner lecture on complexity, and on that front I cannot contribute much. When people are concerned about terrorism, they prefer really simple answers so that they can decide for themselves, will I be next or will I be safe? Complex answers are not welcome, because perhaps we're not very good at handling complexity, just as we are not really good at estimating probabilities of risks. However, we live in risk societies, but the way we assess our risks are often intuitive and primitive. The risk of being killed in an airplane by means of a terrorist is less than 1 in 25 million. It's about 50 times smaller than being killed by a lightning, but we're still more afraid about terrorism than about lightnings. We develop models to reduce complexity of the world into something that we can mentally handle, but as has been stressed briefly this morning, we should not mix up models with the reality itself, which is always more complicated, has more variables than the models. In that sense, the social sciences are much more difficult than the physical science. Last week I was lecturing in Leiden on the same desk that Albert Einstein had been lecturing, and he had only to deal with simple atoms that behave basically the same way all the time, except when you go into quantum theory, when you're getting very close to the absolute zero, they start to behave funny too, in probabilistic ways rather than determined ways. But people are not like that. We have scheming peoples, atoms don't scheme. We have self-fulfilling and self-defeating prophecies. So this is a difficult area. Terrorism is complex. Tourism is very complex, as we heard this morning. And if you bring the two complexities together, it's getting even more complicated. Terrorism is relatively marginal phenomenon in terms of real casualties. 100 people die every year, for instance, just from swallowing ballpoints, which is a strange thing to do. But tourism is a huge industry, as we heard this morning. Every 12th worker in the world is in it. It's one of the fastest growing sectors in the economy, but it's a very volatile and vulnerable sector, subject to shifting consumer tastes, subject to economic cycles, domestic political instability, and shocks caused by both domestic and international terrorism. But domestic terrorism is about 7 times more frequent than international terrorism. Let me say a couple of things about terrorism. Something like pornography, you know it when you see it, you think it, but in fact it is a bit more complicated. It's often confused with political violence, but there are about 60 different manifestations and forms of political violence, from arson to genocide. And the international community, and that is one of the problems with fighting terrorism, has not agreed on a universal legal definitions. You have national definitions. The US government has about 20 that are operative. We have regional ones. Europe has one since 2002. But if you look at the Europol reports, they don't use the European definition. Each country puts in data based on its own national definition. I try to create at least some consensus in the academic field. First, I tried in a report to the UN in the early 90s to cut through the Gordian knot of confusion about definition. I said, well, maybe it's the best thing that we just take an accepted definition and stretch its meaning a bit. And I said, let's take war crimes. War crimes like genocide and torture is something we know what it is, we all agree on it. So why not expand war crimes into peacetime and call acts of terrorism the peacetime equivalents of war crimes? Unfortunately, I could convince only the Indian Supreme Court to go down this road in the UN Ad Hoc Committee on Terrorism, which is part of the Sixth Committee of the General Assembly. Discussion has been going on from 72 to 78, stopped then, was resumed in 1999. It's now in its 13th year, especially Article 2 of the Comprehensive Draft Convention on Terrorism. They have not reached anything there, because, especially because of the Islamic Conference objection to include anything that would stop Palestinians or Kashmiris fighting for their rights, no matter what they do. But in academia, I have made three attempts to come to a consensus definition in the 1980s, basically drafting a definition based on existing definitions, sending them to experts, get their feedback. I've gone through three iterations. The academic consensus definition, as you will find it in the Terrorism Research Handbook that's coming out this summer, is terrorism refers on the one hand to a doctrine about the presumed effectiveness of a special form or tactic of fear-generating coercive political violence, and on the other hand to a conspiratorial practice of calculated, demonstrative, direct, violent action without legal or moral restraints, targeting mainly civilians and non-combatants, performed for its propagandistic and psychological effects on various audiences and conflict parties. So it's a very complicated definition. If we try to apply it, I try to cover a broad range, and there are three basic situations where terrorism occurs, and only two are of major relevance for international tourism. The first context is basically that terror tactics are used by repressive governments as an illegitimate, illegal, indiscriminate form of repression. That we can find in many authoritarian states. It rarely affects international tourists. It affects very much the local population. In fact, you can have severe local repression and a policy of welcoming tourism at the same time. Think of Egypt, Tunisia, Myanmar. The second context of terrorism is the one where one or both sides in quasi-civil war situations, and sometimes in international war, which has almost died out, when they use irregular and illicit tactics like taking hostages. Such zones of conflict where terror shock tactics are applied to next to other forms of political violence are usually no longer major tourist destinations. An example would have been Sri Lanka until the defeat of the LTTE, but tourism never really completely dried out there, and in fact tourists were hardly targeted. It was more by accident that tourists were killed there. The third context, in which is the one where in times of peace and outside direct conflict zones, when weak opposition forces try to gain a higher profile in the public mind, basically the classical propaganda by the deed terrorism, spectacular actions that are meant to show the world that the local government cannot in fact control all territory all the time or protect local peoples or visitors. So to gain international attention, foreigners are sometimes taken hostage, sometimes killed. It is this context that's of our main concern today. And what is the logic behind such attacks? Tourists are civilians, and if you look at the category of targets of terrorism, civilians are prominent, otherwise it would not be terrorism in some way, but a different form of warfare. Civilians are attacked for a variety of reasons. they are, as we heard this morning, easy targets, and they often lack situational awareness. Tourists are also concentrated in tourist resorts, hotels, sightseeing points, so they are easy to ambush. They are usually representatives of a wider group, which are often seen as rich, white, Western elites, so attacking some of them can scare many others. They are also a source of revenue for the local government, or when kidnapped, a source of revenue for ransom monies. And tourists can also be attacked abroad when you cannot hit the country. For instance, one of the attacks in the 1990s in Egypt that hit, I think, 18 Greek tourists was meant for Israelis, and the terrorists just mistook the two. For the terrorists, tourists are usually unimportant in themselves, but important to convey a message to third parties. Messages like, your government cannot protect you all the time, everywhere, or we can strike at places and times of our own choosing and are strong. Remember, for instance, when the IRA in, I think, 1984 bombed Brighton Hotel, where the Conservatives were meeting, and it was a failure, but in IRA's eyes, a glorious failure, and one of the IRA spokesmen commented, remember, you've been lucky today, but you have to be lucky all the time, and we have to be lucky only once to hit you. So these are the sort of messages that are conveyed. It does often not really matter which individual tourist or which group is targeted, or even where they are targeted, as long as the attack can be linked directly or through some message construction or through the location to the enemies of the terrorists. And the internet and the media allow the terrorists to link an attack in a country A to a government in country B, so that the location often becomes secondary. In other words, there can be a substitution of targets without detracting much from the message to be conveyed by a specific attack. Tourists can be hit at sightseeing points like Luxor's, and of course hotels have been major targets. We have seen 30 attacks, major attacks on hotels in 15 countries in the 8 years prior to 9/11. Since then, we've seen, well, my count is 62 countries, but it's probably higher now after these attacks in Afghanistan, in the 8 years after 9/11. So more than double of attacks, also in more countries, about 20 countries. And the number of fatalities due to vehicle-based bombs and so on has also increased by a factor of six and a half in these cases. And often, as has been pointed out this morning, flying glass is the main killer. And many places do not yet have this protective film. There is, of course, also an intrinsic value in attacking hotels for jihadists. These are Western cultural elites. Men and women are mingling with each other. They consume alcohol, they dance, all things that are not really to the liking of jihadists. And jihadists also might see hotels as a place where corrupt elites meet with the powers of the world. So there are tempting targets, and in some ways there are sitting ducks. Not all hotels are as well protected as the Marriott's and the Ritz. That I was very impressed by the security measures that you had in place, but I just thought not all hotels can afford such a level of protection. Airlines like El Al can spend up to a third of their money on security, but not every other airline could do it, and not every other hotel could do it. And if you harden targets, some tourists welcome that. Others see it as a sign, well, there's a threat there, so I might better check it into a local inn and keep a low profile. Let me just review some findings on the nexus on terrorism and tourism. And much of the study has been done rather from the side of the tourist industry than from the terrorist researchers. We have several major databases that look at categories of incidents. One of them is the World Incident Tracking System of the US National Counterterrorism Coordinator. For the 6 years between 2004, when they took over from the State Department with tracking events, until 2009, they recorded only 77 incidents where tourists were involved. It cost the life of 196 people, 808 got wounded, and 94 got taken hostage, all told about 1,098 victims resulting from these 77 attacks. So on the average, it's between 2 and 3 people getting killed, and between 11 and 12 getting injured. And most of these incidents were confined to just 10% of all the countries. If you look at the different database, the Global Terrorism Database of the University of Maryland, which was based on the Pinkerton database, that database covers a much longer period, from 1970 to 2007. It's going on. I could find only 365 incidents involving tourists. It's about 10 incidents per year. And considering the fact that the database contains 82,000 domestic and international incidents, 365 incidents for almost 40 years is not that much. It's only about 1 in 500 terrorist incidents has targeted tourists or hit tourists. And most of these incidents, again, have been confined by about to 10% of the countries, 20 countries or so. So while you see tourists as a prime target of terrorism, in fact, if you look at the totality of terrorism in the world, they are not that prominent, though in recent years there has been an increase. But the impact of such targeting on national economies can be severe. We've heard this morning how 7-7 impacted, but in other countries where, like Egypt, for instance, after the Luxor attack, that really cost them billions of dollars. But the good news was that 2 years later, it was already back to the same level of tourism. And also, in the catastrophe that Luxor was, the good news was that the movement that responsible for it, Gamma al-Islamiyya, split over the effects, because here they wanted to liberate the people and they deprived the people of a major source of income, so people turned against the terrorists. Unfortunately, in Taba they came back, but that was 8 years later. The impact is not only bad for some developing countries, also bad for some developed countries. Walter Enders and Todd Sandler did a study on the effects of terrorism on tourism in Spain in the period 1970-1988, and they found that a typical incident scared away over 140,000 tourists when all impact months were combined. So it's a major disruption. You've seen it after 9/11 when airline passenger loads went down, hotel bookings in New York went down up to 50% for a while. It took a couple of months until it came back. There are two types of situations when terrorism is affected. One is when you have really severe incidents like 9/11 or first Bali bombing. If people perceive these attacks as unique one-off events, that doesn't scare them as much than when you have a series of attacks, even if these attacks are smaller, and then some tourist destinations can just disappear, like Lebanon did for a while, tourists, as opposed to business travel, can easily switch from one destination to the other. For instance, after 9/11, many Americans prefer to go to Hawaii rather than to Europe. The customers of tourist products are flexible, while the tourist destinations, except the cruise ships, cannot move. And sometimes it's the story of the weakest link in the chain. I remember in the 1980s when there were a couple of attacks, Schwechat, the Fiumicello by Abu Dhidal, that kept, and some attacks in Greece as well, that kept a lot of Americans out of Europe, basically, because they associated the whole European area as an area where they could no longer be safe. What can be done about it? Well, there are two basic strategies. You can try to improve the security situation, which is a difficult task and asked for a lot of resources. And you can try to change the security perception. And changing perception is easier, can be done through advertisement campaigns and so on. But in the end, what counts is the real situations. You cannot just through manipulating perceptions bring in more tourists permanently. Also, the expectations of tourists about the risk of terrorism are often false. They overestimate these risks, while they completely underestimate the risks of being a victim of local crime, of being a victim of local parasitic diseases. So there is no realistic assessment there. The tourists themselves, of course, can also take certain precautions. If you go to the websites of the UK government, the US government, or the Dutch government, which is mine, you get excellent travel advice. And, I have often heard at security conferences, well, when you go there, don't go into Marriott. But after I've heard your story this morning, I thought, well, maybe it's not so bad. I was completely amazed how many security measures you had taken here. I think there has been a turn, not just by terrorism, also by natural disasters like the tsunamis, in consequence management for the tourist industry. And organizational resilience is being built up, but not all countries have the sort of resources that Israel or the United States or the UK has. And it's also important, in my view, that you build up resilience against all hazards, not just terrorism, because the investments are substantial, and if you focus just on one narrow segment of disasters, you are probably getting it wrong. A couple of references have been made to the role of the media this morning. My first book on terrorism was called Violence as Communication, Search and Terrorism in the Media. And I identified in that book the Western news value system as a major culprit in basically making terrorism so attractive. The values of our commercial media are such that good news is bad news is good news, it sells more copy, it draws a bigger crowd. If it bleeds, it leads. So certain principles of the news business directly invite the type of violence. It's the only violence, the only language the West understand, one of the tourists says. Brigitte Nakos, herself a journalist and an academic lecturer, I think has identified the relationship between tourism and between terrorism and the media correctly when she said, the news media and terrorists are not involved in a love story. They are strange bedfellows in a marriage of convenience. Despite the fact that journalists are no longer off limits for terrorists, the way journalism is reporting on terrorism often makes me, leaves me flabbergasted. I was receiving, when I was in St. Andrews, directing a center for terrorism and political violence there, I was getting phone calls from all over the world, from South Africa when a bomb had exploded in Spain, and they wanted a comment. And I said, why don't you write about the state terrorism of Mugabe? It's much closer home, or what's going on in your prison. And this, they want some quotable quotes, the more drastic, the more exaggerated, the better. It makes a headline for them. I was often exasperated at this search for sensation and basically asking silly questions to terrorists. What is your deadline? What are your demands? When they haven't even made demands. So I think a lot has to happen in journalism to become more responsible. But unfortunately, journalism, which used to be heavily influenced by party politics, is now heavily influenced by commercial considerations. And whether a medium has guidelines on terrorist coverage or not, once the story breaks and people switch zap from one station to the other, these guidelines are often forgotten. So how to involve the media in this whole business is, I think, still an unsolved business. Well, what can be done? As I said, been said this morning, the tourist industry cannot do it alone. It has to be a public-private partnership. But in the end, the only way to bring down, you cannot even stop terrorism, is that you reinforce the normative systems that exist in our society. So that's a task for the guardians of our normative systems, the schools, the secular and religious teachers, the parents and political leaders, and also the media. That line between civilian targets and military targets, combatants and non-combatants, has become blurred in recent years. And people like Bin Laden basically say, for us it doesn't make a difference whether it's a soldier or a civilian. That line has to be redrawn, has to be strengthened, and only when that is done, I think we will have a more permanent reduction of terrorism. Terrorism can be managed to some extent, it can be controlled, it cannot be eliminated completely in a world system where mobility is so great and information and people travel so much. So in the end, total security is inachievable, but if we educate the public to the risks that are there, and if the security services do what they can, and they do a lot, and they can a lot, and we only see these attacks that have actually taken place, but the failed attacks and the foiled attacks, there are many of those. And in fact, it's amazing how many attacks have been prevented. And there, I think civil society plays a role. They are, in the end, the eyes and ears. And as has been said this morning, we all have to be attentive and keep our eyes open and report suspicious behavior. So we all enjoy tourism. It's one of the biggest industries in the world. And I think one of the things that I'm talking about Islamist terrorists now is they want basically to keep us out of one part of the world while at the same time infiltrating our part of the world. And we have to make a stand and build up strong defenses both here and wherever travelers go there in order to withstand this attack on globalization, basically. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Schmidt. Do we have questions for Professor Schmidt?
I've got a question.
Yes.
You said that. Thank you. You said quite a number of attempts have been foiled. Do you have any ideas on why they were foiled? I mean, are there any common elements between those failed attempts?
Well, I think we all estimate the professionalism of most terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
There are many people who are lone wolves. They learn their lessons from the internet and sometimes the whole thing explodes in their bathroom, which is the best. But there's a lot of amateurism there. That is one reason. Sometimes people change their minds, drop out, do not explode themselves in the best possible place, as if they had some hesitations. I think this morning we saw on some of the PowerPoints again that they were not choosing the best possible locations for mass casualties. There is, I think, a different picture for a different type of terrorist. Religious terrorists trained in Pakistan will react differently than converts in Germany that just try to do their first steps. Of course, some of them have been trained in the army, Egyptian terrorists, and they have learned some of the skills there, and they're more dangerous. But what problem with foiled attacks is that information of them is incomplete, and so analysis is quite difficult. I hear at least most of these sort of attacks in the courtroom when the actual attack that took place and for which they are accused brought to trial is revealed. And then you hear of a lot of other attempts that fail. But one thing that emerges from these is they are quite opportunistic in their targeting. If one doesn't work, then they go to the other. So targeting one target moves them away to another, but of course it also kills people. But we often estimate the professionalism and training of these people. And so despite the fact that suicide bombers have increased the overall lethality of terrorist attacks, except for the vehicle-based attacks, average suicide bomb takes about 12 people down and injures, of course, many more, especially if it's in an area with glass or within a confined room. It has increased lethality, but not as much as it could have. And all that talk that you find in the media and from think tanks about CBRN terrorism, that has been largely misguided. I mean, if you look at some of the internal communications of terrorists, you read sentences like Zawahiri once writing, "We hear so much that they are scared about CBRN. We should look into the better." So
if I
they often get
just
ideas.
Clarify CBRN. We talk about chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear attacks. Just to clarify the term for those who are not familiar.
And many of these things, like ricin, it's not really a weapon of mass destruction. It's a poison. It's been used by secret services. There are a lot of recipes on the internet. Half of them are probably wrong. It's really easy to make. It's not a weapon of mass destruction.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further question?
Yes.
David Langhorne, Intercontinental Hotels. Professor, I've got a thought of which your comments will be welcome. If we are correct in our understanding that Salafist terrorism, one of their main aims is to draw together the Muslim Brotherhood into the new caliphate. Now, thinking from a hotel perspective, if we could have a more social approach rather than a physical security approach, or we complement our physical security by, if you like, reaching our hotels out into society to make them more in line with the local Muslims. So if the hotels get attacked, basically it undermines their objective of drawing together the Muslim community.
Well, a social approach, a soft power approach to terrorism is certainly very promising, but it's easy to set up an extra wall, an extra security barrier, put up some more cameras. The social approach is much more vague and diffuse, and are you targeting the right sort of group of people? So that's where the problem comes in. So when you look at how governments invest money in counterterrorism measures, 80-90% goes into gadgets, exotic technical ways of beating the system. But the social sciences have perhaps been not good enough to sell their products. But in some places like Amsterdam, for instance, there have been very comprehensive schemes of trying to reverse radicalization, insisting that the imams speak in Netherlands, educate them locally rather than import them from Morocco. So if you do these things, it has a long-term effect, but you cannot pinpoint the effectiveness. I think Scotland Yard has also done some measures. There was a Muslim contact group that did a lot of good work. But the people they work with are often people that are not the moderate Islam, but they are dropouts, ex-extremists, often wanted by Interpol because their government wants it. So you have to work with these people to bring about social change. Then the sort of measures that have to be taken in one country with Algerians in France or Pakistanis in the UK, they're different. You have to be culturally sensitive to what goes down well and what doesn't go down well. So in principle, yes, it's a correct approach. It's underutilized. It's a complex and difficult approach, however.
But specifically, I'm thinking that it's used at a tactical level. So for instance, we change an attack on a hotel that is well engaged with its local community, is cognizant and sensitive to the religious aspects of its operating environment. So therefore, an attack on a specific hotel that is well engaged with the social aspects of its environment will be counterproductive to the terrorists in the fact that it becomes perceived that the attack on the hotel is also an attack on the local Muslim community. That's what I'm getting at. Not the grand schemes, political schemes, but the tactical application of social approaches.
Yeah, I think the more it's embedded in a society, the better. But as we have international terrorists moving from one country to another, then the local embeddingness doesn't really help that much. So there's only so much you can do. It helps perhaps against local terrorists. And as I said, with the Luxor attack, most people saw that they could no longer act as taxi drivers, as tourist guides, so they really sided with the government against the terrorists. And intelligence came from the people that helped to arrest them. But you have to work on both sides, basically.
Thank you very much, Professor. I think that we cannot take any other question. So let's thank Professor for his insight. And we'll be moving swiftly to our next presenter. Short break for technological adjustments. So it gives me a great pleasure to present Dr. Dawn Gilpin from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Media at Arizona State University. In this presentation, we are going to move from the academic perspective of terrorism and tourism to more complexity side of it. So that we start thinking a little bit more complexity.
Yes. We're good. Yes, thank you very much, everyone. Thanks especially to our organizers who invited me to be here today. I am in fact, going to be the first intrepid soul to talk about complexity. I'm not going to go into a lot of details about all of the principles of complexity, because that would be a completely different kind of presentation. But some of the concepts will come up organically as I talk, and I'm sure they'll be drawn together in the final moments of today's proceedings. My presentation is also going to be very different from the sort of thing that we've seen so far today. One, because I'm not specifically involved in tourism, nor am I an expert on terrorism. So you might wonder why I'm here. My area, my discipline is communication, mass media, and specifically in public relations, and I've been working with theories of complexity, specifically in the area of crisis and issues management, for a few years now. So I'm really interested in the opportunity to discuss some of the ways that complexity can perhaps help us think through problems in a different way than what we're used to, and maybe propose some solutions. So as I said, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about complexity, but I do need to start off with a quick and dirty summary of what I see as sort of three main points that need to be made when we're talking about what makes complexity and a complexity approach to organizations or to crises different from what we might have seen in the past. And I should also point out that my discussion here is at a more meta level, a sort of a big picture level. I'm not going to be talking so much about immediate on the ground first line of response to a crisis event, but more about questions of how we can try to protect the legitimacy of tourism as an industry and individual organizations or perhaps destinations within this system of tourism. So what are we talking about? First of all, when you're talking about complexity, the history of whatever it is you're looking at is very important. All crises come from a specific series of events and contexts that have played into each other over time. And the reason that it says non-retraceable is that this is a distinguishing feature of complexity. If we had a magical undo button for life, like in a software program, which would be fantastic, but we don't. But if we did, from a complexity perspective, even if we got to a certain point and went back a few steps, that doesn't guarantee that we would have the same options for progressing forward. You might have heard the saying that insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. As I often like to point out, that's also one possible definition of complexity. You can make of that what you will, those of us who like to look at it. But so that's the idea, is that you can't just naturally trace things back, and everything comes with a past. And as I said, everything also comes with a context. So you have to think, and this just came up in the discussion of embeddedness, and it's been brought up in a few different instances today already, is that there are always specific times, places, specific moments, and involving specific actors and relationships in particular. And another distinguishing feature of complexity is that it shifts our emphasis from the actors in a system to the relationships among them. And these networks of relationships are crucial when you're trying to understand what happened, potential causes, and outcomes, and how everything fit together. So that's kind of, as I said, the quick and dirty summary. So I'm not an expert on tourism, but I have looked into it a little bit, and I've been a tourist, so, right? And I think that there are a few features of tourism that make it a particularly delicate problem when you're talking about crises and from a complexity perspective. So I just have a couple of things that I wanted to draw your attention to that you can be thinking about while we're talking about how to approach the situation. So one tension has to do with change and the status quo. So in a complex system, change is a given. It's dynamic. Because it's about relationships and not just about the actors, when there is relating going on, that means the system is evolving. And if it stops evolving and stops changing, it's no longer complex and it's something else entirely. So change is very important. And there's been a lot of talk today about how tourism is changing and how things have shifted, even the kinds of competencies that are expected from people in the industry over time. But at the same time, when you are selling a tourism product, you're selling a set of expectations that is expected to remain pretty stable. People want to know what they're getting into. They want to have the security of what they are going to be seeing. It's often tied to different times in the past. So this idea of bouncing back or returning to a status quo is not very compatible with complexity in general. Because we can't retrace that timeline, there really is no status quo. We're always moving forward like sharks. Another tension that I think exists in tourism, it has to do, as I just mentioned it, is the different points in time. Where is tourism going? What are people going to want? How are things changing in the future? What's the economy going to be like? What are the modes of transportation going to be like? One of the classes that I teach at ASU, at Arizona State, is PR campaigns. And we have student teams that work with actual clients. And this semester, one of our clients is called the Spaceship Company. And it is a supplier to Virgin Galactic, which will be selling space tourism. So, you know, whole new frontier of tourism to be looking towards in the future. And as I said, so much of tourism is also about selling the past and the history of a specific area or a location, and even the history of the industry, that people have their expectations built up. So these are some tensions that tourism presents that can be complicated for complexity. There's also institutionalization, which just means really that things have become ingrained. You know, and we've had a lot of shifts in institutionalization. We've had to adapt to a whole new process when we fly, right? The kinds of measures that we didn't have to do 10 years ago, yes, just under the wire 10 years ago, now we have to go through a whole set of security procedures, but even those have become institutionalized. You take off your shoes, you take your laptop out, you put it in, you get used to these ways of doing things. Governments, although, you know, we heard this morning that governments can be swift and adopt fast measures when they see the need for it and when they are structured, possibly, but often government agencies tend to be slow to move. Even some big organizations in general can be slow to move. So that's another, since we're talking about adaptive change, institutionalization, another barrier. And finally, one characteristic of complex systems is that they have generally lots of actors in them, lots of moving parts, and this is one of those cases where a lot of what I've wanted to say has already been said before, and that is that many of the actors who are involved in the tourist industry don't necessarily see themselves as part of it. So you've got, yes, all of your different aspects of the tourism, the airlines and the cruise companies and hotels and travel agents, etc. But you also have local businesses who may or may not see themselves as part of the industry. And if you're trying to figure out how to fit all these parts together, it can be difficult. Another important thing is that we're talking about lots of different levels of scale when we talk about complex systems. So we can say these are things that are true at the local level. We can say that at a national level, you know how you have many actors involved, but it's also an international issue when a lot of the incidents that we've seen portrayed today have international components, and also they have international impacts. Even if it just happened in India, doesn't mean it doesn't affect lots of other parts of the system. So there are a lot of balls to keep in the air. True, as I said, of any complex system, but I think in tourism it's particularly tricky. So that's what we're dealing with here. That's in terms of complexity. We've talked about a few different definitions of crisis. I want to give you another one. I think it's important to talk about what I mean anyway when I'm talking right now about a crisis, and from a complexity standpoint, what we should and can expect in terms of outcomes and how we can judge a successful outcome of a crisis. So Carl Weick, who's an organizational theorist, used this term. It's too bad that Bernard left, because we had a discussion over dinner last night. He hated this term. But Carl Weick called crises a cosmology episode, which just means it's a world-changing episode. If you are, from the perspective of someone who is involved, directly involved in a crisis, for example, a terrorist attack, it can shift your entire perception of the world. You know, you might feel threatened. You see everything differently. Completely world-changing. In complexity terms, we can call that a bifurcation point. At that point, the system changes direction completely. Again, at all these different levels. So that's what we mean by crisis. It can sometimes be something that is built up over time. It's almost always built up over time from lots of different factors that have contributed, but that is the moment that changes everything. And as I said, we talk about the status quo. So a lot of people, traditional crisis management literature, pre-complexity, I guess you would say, and often just people talking about crises, and a lot of managers see the successful outcome of a crisis as a return to how things were. I mean, I've already said that's not really compatible. So what we're looking for as a successful outcome of a crisis from a complexity standpoint is transformation. Not just any transformation, but transformation that adapts successfully, that's going to allow the system, whether we're talking about a hotel chain or the tourism industry as a whole or a particular destination, to continue to exist and thrive. So that's what we like to see in complexity. I think I missed one. How did that happen? All of my fancy graphics were not. Okay. The other successful outcome, and something that is necessary in order to manage a crisis effectively, and we've heard examples of this all day, but is expertise. And I said over dinner last night that even though it's a terrible thing to say, and of course on practical terms, I don't actually wish this, but one of the problems from a crisis management perspective is that there aren't enough crises. Because the way that people who need to manage them become expert is through experience. But not just personal experience, but also working together with other people and developing the ability to recognize patterns, understand what's going on. And we've seen so many examples of these successful groups that the reason that they've been successful at managing crises is that they have started working together, not just meeting and not just sharing information, but really developing an understanding of each other's working styles and knowing what's going on and creating knowledge together and becoming experts together. Like a soccer team, say a World Cup team, you have lots of great players, but they still have to practice together in order to become an effective team. You can't just throw them all on the field the day of the game and expect them to be fabulous. Come on. Okay, there we go. Okay, so that's crisis. Now, in the title of my talk, I talk about attractor basins, which is a complexity term that can scare a lot of people. It can be complicated. I'm gonna try to make it as simple as possible. And the illustration that I have usually found to be the easiest way to explain attractor basins is a bunch of jelly beans. It works for me. So if you think about, you might have heard the term attractors from chaos theory, you know, a strange attractor. An attractor basin is an area, think of a space like a jelly bean, that's characterized by different patterns of thought and action. So within the red jelly bean, there are people and organizations practicing redness, and they talk about redness, and they're just red all the time. And then, So within each jelly bean, there is this culture, you might call it. And so there are all these different cultures. And the system, which can be an organization or it can be, like I said, the entire tourism industry, moves through this set of jelly beans. And different parts of it, especially if it's big, have different characterizations. So we might say that over here, the red jelly bean, that's all about business tourism. So it's about meeting procurement and business travel, these kinds of issues, whereas another might be about ecotourism, the green jelly bean, and so on and so forth, right? And these can take all kinds of different forms. And there are events, these bifurcation points that I discussed earlier, the cosmology episode, can cause things to jump into different jelly beans. Or it can scatter the system and make lots of different attractor basins involved in the system. Hopefully the example that I give at the end here will clarify exactly what I'm talking about. I'm going to use the example of Mumbai to try to bring some of these concepts together so they're not so abstract. For now, we'll stick to the jelly beans. So there you have all our jelly beans, and there are spaces between them that are volatile, and you can find yourself in a green jelly bean, and if you get zipped off to the blue jelly bean, you suddenly have to learn how to deal with blueness and talk about blue and be blue all the time. So these are the attractor basins. These are different cultural, different meanings, different practices, different approaches to whatever the issue or system is. So what are we talking about? If we're looking for attractor basins, and that's what I want to get at, is that one useful way of looking at a situation, an industry, or a country, or your own organization's problems is to try to figure out what are the attractor basins that are around you. So what are you looking for? You can look for an issue like security, right? What are the issues that are important to people that people coalesce around? In public relations scholarship, we talk about how the republics form when enough people care about something. That's how you form a public. They form around an issue. So what are the issues that are out there? Questions of image, and this can be, again, image of your organization, image of a destination, image of tourism in general. What sort of values? And here we're talking about individual values. We're also talking about deeply embedded cultural values in the different destinations that you might be working with. Values of the industry. Questions of identity, again, can be cultural identity, organizational identity, and enactment, which is how people behave. So how people put all these thoughts and everything into action. Because when we're talking about communication or beliefs, it all leads to changes in behavior, and that, of course, is what's going to have impact. Yeah, I cannot get this right today. There we go. So, last but not least, before we get to the example, I do want to talk a little bit about communication and the role of it. As I said, the complex systems shift the emphasis from the actors to the relationships. So we shouldn't be looking so much at silos. Not silos in terms of areas. Regional areas we're so densely connected now that we can't really look at them in isolation. Can't even really look at the tourism industry in isolation, as we've seen. It's so interdependent with so many other parts of our economic and global society. So the key here is the communication. That is what connects all of these relationships. That's how we build and maintain our relationships. We establish them through communication, and it works much better from a complexity perspective if you're really aware of the effects of the kind of communication you do, and as I said, how it changes behavior. So James Carey, who was a communication scholar, pointed out that really it's through communication that we create our reality, but not in some sort of hippy-dippy way about how we construct it, but actually how we shape our thoughts, which then guide our actions and change the way that we behave. So it's really important to be thinking about communication as sort of the connective tissue that links together these actors in any kind of system. Actors within your organization, actors within a country, parts of the tourism industry as a whole. Okay, now we're going to get to the practical example, so hopefully this will start to make sense. So I don't have to, we've already had a great sort of backgrounder on Mumbai and what happened there. I'm going to sort of go through the kinds of factors that you might look at if you're trying to analyze it from this complexity perspective and understand what happened and put it into the context of these attractor basins. So first, as I said in the beginning, you're looking at very specific context and point in time and history, and these are just a couple of factors. You have to take into account that it happened in the post-September 11th world, right, where there is a global heightened attention to security matters, that if the same type of event had happened pre-September 11th, whatever came next might have been a little bit different. It also came as the global economic crisis was really starting to become painful everywhere, and India in particular was affected by it. Another factor, which would have been completely impossible to predict, but in retrospect we can see that it probably had an effect, is a law that was instituted in the UK about corporate manslaughter, which held organizations responsible, liable for their employees' well-being, and probably played a role in the kind of, it changed the decision environment that executives were working with when they had to decide whether they were going to maintain their commitment to a trade show or some other kind of business travel, or make their people stay home, which then obviously had severe consequences for India. And there are so many other things that I could bring in here. There's no way to list every possible factor. But these are all aspects that shaped the attractor basins within which this crisis evolved. If you look at tensions with Pakistan, et cetera, et cetera. Afterwards, things started to happen and took into different took different directions based on the way people interpreted factors such as I mentioned, post 9/11 world. In fact, there were reports that called it September 11th part two. There was a lot of discourse about fear and security. There were travel advisories issued by numerous countries warning citizens that they shouldn't travel to India, instilling a sense of fear, especially if you're talking about leisure travel, which is a little bit more expendable, as was already brought up. There's the symbolic capital, also came up, the importance of the Taj Mahal Hotel. But the hotel in the public imagination, and so the impact that it had on the identity of people in the area and throughout India. And another completely impossible to predict factor that had some effects was just a few weeks later, in January of 2009, the movie Slumdog Millionaire was released. Hugely popular, Oscar winner, and by many accounts probably increased interest in tourism, or tourism in the poorer areas of Mumbai and India as a whole. That probably had a counter effect on things that, on tourism. Clearly the effects weren't limited to Mumbai itself, but extended to other parts of India. Might have extended to Italy too. There were lots of media accounts about the economic repercussions that created a climate of fear and doubt that might have caused a lot of people to hesitate. And there were advisories about how to be terror-proof in your travel. So, for example, keep your cell phone off because otherwise, you don't want it to go off in the case of a terror attack. These are all things that shape the way that people think about India, that they think about travel in general, and is going to have some kind of effect on their behavior. And here's a quote by a tour operator who is making specific reference, the key phrase, back to normal. And from a complexity perspective, while this might seem a perfectly normal thing to say, things will get back to normal soon, from a complexity perspective, this is actually dangerous. as a way of thinking, because if you assume that this time is going to be like other instances that you know, then you might be overlooking a lot of potential risks. So even if in the short term things do get back to normal, that doesn't say much about the adaptive quality of the system as a whole, because we're talking long term here. So that transformation that we would look for is missing. Another really important aspect of what happened in India is that with Mumbai is that it took place when social media had already taken off in a big way, and all over the world people were participating in a way in this event in ways that wouldn't have been possible even just maybe a couple of years, even a year before, much less 2 or 3 or 4 years prior. So there were tweets, there were blogs, there were people uploading photos to Flickr. They created a Google map with the sites and little notes about what happened. These are all links, but pointless to go through all of them. And it's worth noting that most of these social media communications that people were involved with were not by official sources or travel sources. Some of them were misinformation, undoubtedly. Some of them were from people who were on the site where things were happening, although if you've ever been anywhere, you know that just being on the spot doesn't mean that you necessarily understand everything that's going on, right? You have your own perspective, but you don't have a big picture. So even if you are in good faith reporting from what's going on, you might be taking people's perceptions in a different direction, inadvertently. So all of this was also shaping the way that people thought about Mumbai and the kind of connection that people felt to it. They had some good things. They also decided to create, you might say, or foster, encourage other attractor bases, other ways of thinking about the country. The Indian government created the Visit India program, which focused on rural versus the cities, because the cities were perceived as more dangerous. So they created a set of thought patterns. Obviously, the thing about complexity is you can't really control what will happen, but if you create the conditions where there are alternate interpretations and alternate perceptions available, then you increase the possibility that there will be adaptive solutions that will come out of this mix. They even won an award for their resilience, and I think resilience is another word that I have a troubled relationship with, but I think if we think of it not so much as bouncing back to the status quo, but as adaptiveness, then it works. So we've talked a little bit already, we've already heard the term complexity reduction. That's what people typically like to do because it makes their world feel more controllable. They try to sort everything into much more limited, orderly, less messy boxes where they feel that they understand it. So in terms of complexity reduction, what happened? There were some threat rigidity responses, which means that you keep doing what you've been doing, or you try to shut down even more and use a command and control approach because, again, it makes you feel safer. That's a complexity reduction. The emphasis on fear and risk tries to say that inconvenience is a good trade-off for increased security. But if you're talking about...
Fear and risk.
There we go.
Crisis management in action.